Hi, my name is Thomas. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 25th, 1981. Potomac Oaks is my home group. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor other men. I have a privilege of sponsoring other men. And I have the privilege to be here tonight to be of service to the program that saved my life. Just out of curiosity, is there anyone here that's new, like 90 days or less? Welcome. Welcome. This is where the hope is. This is where, if you jump in to Alcoholics Anonymous and do what's asked of you, you can have a life beyond your wildest dreams. Doesn't mean you're going to be a multimillionaire, but you'll be able to live in your own skin. That's been my experience, because I've had a lot of bad stuff happen to me in sobriety, but I didn't have to drink over it. And I found peace. And let me tell you, for someone like me, peace was something that I just didn't get from the moment I was like this big. Back home, people like to make fun of me because I have unbelievable amounts of energy. Some people would call that hyper. When I was young, I was like I am today to like the 10th power. I mean, I was just always on the move, always going somewhere. My dad was an alcoholic, active alcoholic for the first 10 years I was around. I come from a very large family, good Irish, Italian, Catholic, you know, 8 kids. My mother actually had 10. For whatever reason, out of those kids, I was the one. I was like the scapegoat. I got all my dad's abuse from his drinking. And I never knew why. I just knew that I didn't feel like I was enough, ever. Didn't matter that I made the all-star team in baseball. Didn't matter that I got mostly A's, maybe 1 B. It was just never seemed like it was good enough. And I grew up feeling like I wasn't good enough. Like I just didn't fit in. And I had all this energy. And, you know, my mother, God bless her, I mean, she is chasing around all these kids in diapers because, you know, back then they didn't have Pampers. You actually had to use those cloth things, right? And I would, like, get home from kindergarten and I would disappear for, like, 3 hours until dinner. And she would just be frantic. And, you know, she found a great solution for that. One day I got home from kindergarten. She goes, "Hey, come here for a minute." I went up into the kitchen. She tied me to a chair. Can't believe you're laughing at that. Like, that's funny. You guys are sick. This is good. I fit right in here. You know, I drank over that for a long time. And you know what? I can look back on that today, and I can see being maybe a little bit less self-centered than I used to be, that she did the best she could. I mean, she didn't know what to do with me. I mean, she was, you know, terrified that I was hit by a car. She didn't know where I was. I was just out exploring. I was being 5, you know? And, I stopped caring about all this stuff that I was going through when I was young the first time I picked up a drink. I was 12 years old, and a friend of mine, it wasn't like I had a plan to go get drunk. He just said, "Hey, my brother's going to get us some beers. You want to go?" I was like, "Yeah, all right." This was like one of my only 2 friends, and I didn't want to like upset him because, you know, even from a very young age, I was a people pleaser, and I would do anything if you would just accept me because I just didn't feel like I deserved any acceptance. And so, "You want to go drink?" "Sure." I don't know what that looks like. You know, I know my dad does that, but so we went and he got 2 six packs of beer. And, you know, when I was 12, I was like 5 foot nothing. I weighed 100 and nothing. I mean, I was a bean stick. And I remember shotgunning those 6 beers in about 5 minutes. Now, when you put 6 beers into a frame that size that has never had a drink of alcohol before ever, magic happens. I mean, I just remember not caring about my dad, not caring about the beatings, not caring about not fitting in. I just remember walking like this for like, you know, an hour. And the next thing I remember, I was in our neighbor's bushes throwing up. And I remember the next day feeling lousy. just terrible. And I told my brother, I was like, oh my God, I went out and I got drunk last night and I wound up in the Clancy's bushes and I was vomit all over me. And my older brothers, they were a lot tougher than me, and they'd just be like, don't worry about it. All of us has wound up in the Clancy's bushes before. I was like, okay. And I didn't worry about it. And it wasn't like from that moment I decided I am going to drink like that forever. I just knew that for an hour, I felt really great. I didn't feel different then. I didn't feel less than. I just felt okay. I was able to like live in my own skin. You know, but when you're 12, you can't go get alcohol in a lot of places. They generally don't sell it to you, especially when you're 12 and you look like you're about 7, right? But luckily I had older brothers, and every now and again, I would be able to get beer. And every time I got beer, it was like the first time. I did not ever sip a beer, ever. As soon as I had a six-pack, it was gone as quickly as I could drink it, because I wanted to feel the way I felt that night. And it's funny, I mean, I didn't know about this until much later, of course, but like, you know, we're unable to remember what happened yesterday, and we don't care what it does to us. You know, I didn't remember that 3 weeks or a month earlier when I was in the Clancy's bushes covered in puke, and the next 2 days that I just felt like death. I didn't care about that. I just knew that I want to capture that 1 hour of bliss. And you know what? It can be like that today. I can do that with like my character defects. You know, it's like I can act out and I'll feel good for like 15 minutes or an hour, and I will justify like the week of pain that I beat myself up over for that 5 minutes of like, oh, that was good, right? You know, my drinking progressed, and I got into high school, and I remember it was the freshman dance. Now, you know, I'm just like a goofy little white kid from the suburbs. I have no rhythm. I don't know how to dance. It's like, you know, some people, they just have that gene in their system, right? If they hear a song, they pop up out of their chairs and they just start dancing. No problem. I'm like the guy that, like, hears the song and says, like, okay, I don't know, should I ask her to dance? Should I not ask her to dance? And it's like I torture myself for, like, 15 minutes. Then finally says, okay, would you like to go dance? The song's over, and then we got to wait for the next song. And then the song starts, and I just remember that awkward moment where I walked out to the dance floor. It's like, okay, now we're out in the dance floor. Okay, ready? 1, 2, 3, go. I mean, I don't have rhythm, and I just feel different. It's like everyone's looking at me. That's what I feel like. And it was so painful. After that dance, I saw one of my brother's, older brother's friends. He's like, hey, let's get out of here. Okay, awesome. We went out, had a quick six-pack. I went back in, and all of a sudden, I found rhythm, you know? It was like, I was ready to dance then, right? Problem was, and this is a really old song. Some of you might remember. It's called Stairway to Heaven. It's a very slow, it's like a slow dance song. Well, I come in like, yeah, Stairway to Heaven, right? I don't care. It's like, that's what alcohol does for me. See, as an alcoholic, alcohol does something for me. Alcohol does the same thing to anyone that drinks it. If you drink enough of it, it'll get you drunk. But what it does for me is, if I look in the mirror at that age, I don't like what I see. I'm like the cross between Ozzy Osbourne and like Steve Buscemi. I just look contorted, right? You put a six-pack in me, and all of a sudden I'm like Brad Pitt and George Clooney. Hey, how you doing, right? I just feel better. I look different. I feel better, and that's the way it just does something for me. It doesn't do that for other people. Other people drink that aren't alcoholic, and they do the strangest thing. When they start to feel it, they stop. Now, when I start to feel it, I keep going. It's like, all right, the end is like, I'm going to get to that place that I remember from the, like, the 5 minutes before the Clancy's bushes. I'm going to get to that place again. And I search for that, and I search for that, and I search for that, and I keep drinking. And every single time, I overshoot the mark. And I always wind up in somebody's bushes. Somewhere. And coincidentally, at that dance, you know, obviously the Christian Brothers, where I was at school, they kind of notice when you're in the middle of a really slow ballad and you're jumping up and around and like it's a fast song. Mr. Buckley, could you come here, please? Let me smell your breath. That was a problem. You can get picked up now, and we'll talk to your parents on Monday. You know, so I had that to look forward to on Monday, which was, you know, not really nice, but they suspended me from school for like 3 days. Another year later, there was another school function, and I was hanging with the people that drank. I mean, why would you hang with anyone else? When you want to drink, you hang with people that drink. That way you don't feel different. It's like everyone's drinking. And that's what I remember telling my parents. What do you mean you don't like my friends? Everybody drinks. And they're like, no, just the people you hang out with drink. Not everybody drinks. And I kept getting in trouble. I got suspended from school 3 times. And it didn't stop me. Now, the problem with this is, when I was 10, before I ever had my first drink, my dad quit drinking. He joined Alcoholics Anonymous. That tends to put a damper on, like, a child's drinking when the father is sober and he sees the son getting in all kinds of trouble, like, with regularity. You know, and a strange thing happened. When my dad got sober, see, when he was drinking, he would search me out, and I was the one that always got smacked around all the time. And then he got sober. He didn't want to hit me anymore. The only thing he ever wanted to do was talk to me. And you know what? I really wasn't sure which was worse. Because, like, he'd smack me around, and it'd be like, okay, 30 seconds, you learn how to scream, and, like pretend that it hurts, but it doesn't really hurt, but, you know. But when he talked to me, it was like an hour. Well, son, I think you need to turn your will over to God. What? I can look back on it today, and I understand what he was trying to do. He was trying to plant a seed into me that, like, my drinking was a problem, and maybe I needed help. And he'd have these talks with unbelievable regularity, trying to plant. Well, when I was 16, 17, 18 years old, he could have thrown those seeds on this. Because the same, I mean, this was not fertile soil, okay? I was not having it. You don't quit drinking when you're 18 years old. I mean, that's when you're really supposed to take off, but I didn't get that chance. You know, but I continued to have problems. I mean, drinking didn't make me quit sports. It didn't make me quit studying. I mean, I made a conscious decision that drinking was more important than playing baseball. Drinking was more important than playing golf. Drinking was more important than all the stuff that I was doing. And so I just stopped doing that stuff. And I remember one night, a friend of mine says, hey, senior prank, we're going to take our sports cars and we're going to go to the high school and we're going to do like big donuts in, across the football field. And I thought, that really doesn't sound like a really smart idea. I don't think I should do that, Raleigh. And a 12-pack later, I was Jeff Gordon. I mean, unfortunately, a guy that I had played basketball back in the day when I played basketball just happened to be strolling the school that night. Caught up to my car. That tells you how I was driving, okay? A guy on foot caught up to my car. Smashed my windshield, called into the police department, told me that I was at the school doing this, and, you know, I had gone home, passed out on the bed. Well, you know, at 2:30 in the morning, the police were at my house, and my dad was waking up, and he was none too pleased with that. And, you know, I didn't have to go to jail for that or anything, but I got quite a slap on the hand, and I think I got grounded. I think I just stopped being grounded about a week ago. He didn't do anything. He just had another one of those conversations with me. And my life was going downhill fast, and I couldn't see it. You know, because when you're drinking, in my case, I was able to tell myself the lie that it was just fun. Well, to the guy that's drinking, it might be fun, but to everyone around them, it is not fun. It is not fun for a parent to watch their son go downhill. It's not fun for brothers and sisters to see you moody and punching holes in walls. I mean, that's not fun to them. But to me, hey, I'm just having a good time. What's the problem? You know, I didn't like hurt my knuckles. It's just like, you know, it's cheap drywall. It was easy. And I remember one night, I had a particularly bad night, and it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I came in. You know, and low jacks weren't even invented then. But somehow, every time that I went out, and it was like a late night, when I would pull in, where I lived in this little cul-de-sac, I could come around the corner, and if the light was on in the kitchen, I was toast. I meant Dad was up, you know. If I was home at midnight, the light was never on. Every night I was home at 2 or 3, the light was on. I was like, oh. So this night, I came home. Have you been drinking? No. Are you sure? No. All right, we're going to talk about this tomorrow. Go to bed. Next day, called me up into the kitchen for one of those famous chats, and he says, look, your mom and I are really concerned about your drinking. You know, you're 18 years old. Your school grades are going down. You're not interested in sports anymore. You know what? We got you a plane ticket. You're going to Minnesota tomorrow to treatment. Well, if I had a list of 1 to 100 of things that I wanted to do the next day, getting on a plane to go to treatment was nowhere on the list, okay? I don't, you know, I'm 18. You don't go to treatment when you're 18. So I went out that night, and, you know, I got as drunk as I could get, and I came in around 5 o'clock in the morning. The light was off in the kitchen. It's like he didn't care. I was going to treatment. Passed out on the bed. He woke me up at 6 o'clock, and he says, all right, come on, let's go. So I threw some clothes in a bag, and off to treatment I went. Well, I've told this story many times. I had my first spiritual experience at the airport. I was walking through the metal detector, and this was like way before 9/11, you know, this was like 1979, but they still had the metal detectors, and I had my hands in my pocket as I was walking through, and I was like, oh my God, I have a metal pipe in my pocket that was not a tobacco pipe, okay? And I was like, this is great. I'm on my way to treatment. I'm getting busted, and this is not going to turn out good, so I just did what any good alcoholic would do. I said, Dad, here, take this. You know, and I figured he knew what's the difference, right? He took the thing, he walked through the metal detector, and nothing happened. And I was sure that there was a God, and he was pissed off at me. I really thought I could have used that thing in treatment, right? You know, I could have scraped something out of the thing and taken the edge off. But God had a different plan for me. And you know what? I can't say good, bad, and different things about treatment. I know the treatment center that I went to got me to look at things that I had never looked at prior to being there. They introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember coming out of treatment and coming home and going to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember walking in the door to this church. And, I mean, you could smoke in the meetings back then. So, I mean, it looked like there was this much clear space and then like a cloud of gray above it. And there wasn't anyone in that room to me less than 70 years old. And I thought, oh my God, it's like, I'm not going to get this. I mean, these people get winded playing chess. I mean, this is not going to be for me. Somebody at 18 will not get what they're offering. Because to me, I just saw my dad, and I still had a lot of unresolved anger. I think they call those resentments towards my dad. And you know what? I didn't get it. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't read the book. I didn't work the steps. And in the first year and a half I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, I went out 3 times. And every time, I mean, I didn't know how it happened. It's like, how did that happen? And I can tell you, every one of those times that I went out, that night, I didn't like the way I felt. And that's what this book says. Alcoholics drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. When I drink, I feel better. That's why I drink. When I don't like the way I feel, I'm going to drink. If I don't have a different solution. And I wasn't listening to the different solution that they had here. So very sheepishly, I went up to this guy who's like this tall and about this wide. And he was only 30 years old. I was like, all right, maybe this guy can help me. Right? He's not 100. You know, he's sober 10 years. Maybe I can get something from this guy. So I went up to him very, you know, look, when you go out 3 times and people know that you're that guy that keeps going and getting drunk, it's kind of like humiliating. And I went up to him after the meeting and I said, hey, Dave, look, I can't seem to stay sober. You know, my way is not working. I need some help. I was wondering if you would sponsor me. And even though Dave was very short, he was very loud. And he just got in my face. So you want me to sponsor you? I was like, Jesus. It's like, well, I mean, I know that I'm new, but I think I just asked you that. Yes. Would you sponsor me? Yeah, I'll sponsor you. Just do two things. I said, all right, what's the first thing? He goes, shut up. You know, I'm a sensitive alcoholic. You know, don't yell at me like that. I mean, come on. He goes, you've been coming around here for a year and a half talking like you know what's going on. You know what's going on. You don't help anybody. You don't do chairs. You don't pick up ass. It was like I was in the ring with Mike Tyson when he was really good. I was like, bam, bam, bam. It was unbearable. I said, okay. I said, what's the second thing? He goes, just shut up. Now, that might seem harsh, but he wasn't 100% harsh. He said, look, you have to come here and you have to learn how to be quiet. You have to learn how to listen. Because it's in the listening that you might hear one thing that's going to get you to stay sober until tomorrow. Just one thing. And then once you build up some practice of that, you might actually be able to carry that message to someone else. And it's in the carrying of the message that's the only time that you moving your lips ever makes sense. Okay, fine. I mean, I didn't talk for a meeting for like a year. I was terrified of Dave. I kept on looking at him like for like a little sign of approval, like sometimes we do with our sponsors. Like, it's okay. No. So I just kept my mouth shut. Well, Dave got me working the steps. You know, I ended up going back to school, and I actually got a scholarship to play golf, to go back to college. And he says, look, you've only got like a little over a year sober. He says, I want you to go find somebody in your college town that can sponsor you because you need somebody that's close to you. So I moved to Erie, Pennsylvania, and I got a guy named Six-Pack Charlie. And you don't have to guess how he got his name. And Six-Pack was a great sponsor. He continued to take me through the steps. And this guy, I mean, he was 20-something years sober, and he was busy. His phone was always ringing. He was always helping people. But there was something else about him. I mean, he always was in a good mood. I was like, how is that possible? I mean, I am crazy 24/7. I can't get my mind to quiet down. And he told me, and he showed me how he got to be that way. By working through the 12 steps. By developing a prayer life. You know, the book says it's going to be the most powerful and important relationship in my life. And that's the relationship I have with God. I mean, look, I had 16 years of Catholic upbringing. I thought I had an idea what God was. But I had no idea. I mean, this is just something I had to do because my parents wanted me to do it. You know, he got me in touch to a power greater than myself. And, you know, I graduated school, got a great job working for Hyatt Hotels. They moved me all over the country. You know, I left New York and I moved to Savannah, Georgia. I was managing the Hyatt there and then to Atlanta. And then I was in Hawaii for like 3 years and then to Chicago. And I got married in Hawaii. And life was good. I found that when I put Alcoholics Anonymous first, when I remembered what my primary purpose was, to carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Okay? When staying sober and taking that action is my primary purpose, everything in my life, it doesn't necessarily just fall into place, but my perception of it is such that I'm okay with it, whatever it is. Don't always like it, but I can live with it and not be crazy about it. Well, Alcoholics Anonymous was my primary purpose for, you know, 15, 16 years. Six-Pack Charlie passed away. And I started to believe my own press release. And I was a young man. I was 35 years old. I was 15 years sober. I had a beautiful wife. I had two great kids. It's like, you know what? My kids are not going to suffer the way I suffered. I am going to be present for them. I'm going to take them to their games. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. Now, when I left Hawaii, my father passed away when I moved to Hawaii. And I'm going to segue for a second. Six-Pack Charlie tried to get me to make amends to my father for like 6 years. He says, look, you need to do this. He says, your amends are done, except for the most important one. You know, and the book talks about that in step 9. I have a problem because I couldn't forgive him. I was unable to forgive all that stuff. There was a part of me that was still playing the victim. You know, if he hadn't beat me so much, maybe I would have felt better. Maybe I would have done this. Maybe I would have done that. What was that movie? I could have been a contender. I still had a lot of angst. And he was trying to get me to do that for years. You see, you can have the best sponsor in the world, but if you don't take the action, I didn't take that action. And I still, every time I was in the room with him, I felt tight. I don't want to feel tight when I'm sober. I want to feel like, Finally one night my mother just says, look, you know, maybe you should just talk to him. And that night, for whatever reason, call it a moment of grace, the light bulb went off and I talked to my dad and I made amends. It's the only time I ever saw my dad cry. It was very powerful. And you know what? He and I had a great relationship for about a year or so. And so when I moved to Hawaii from Atlanta, I figured, you know what? I better go up to New York to see him before I move, because I don't know when I'm going to get back from Hawaii. And I went back and had a great weekend with him and my mom. And he took me to the airport, dropped me off. I told him I loved him. I hugged him. And he told me he loved me. And a week later, I got a call from my brother. He was dead. This is what Alcoholics Anonymous does. When I take the direction as directed by a sponsor, I've now had 22 years that I've thought about my dad with perfect peace, with joy. I mean, I'm in a point now where if I say a crossword to somebody, I'll beat myself up over it, because, you know, I'm not supposed to do that. I'm just supposed to be nice to everybody. That's what I learned here. I have to be other-centered, you know? And so when I don't do that, I can beat myself up pretty good. Now, if I had not mended that relationship before he died, I mean, I would have had 22 years of a lot of like, God, I wish I, you know. I don't have that. Today I've got like, I think about Dad, and it's like, Dad was all right, man. My dad was okay. And the last thing I said to him was, I love you, and he knew it. You know, many years later, my mother passed away, and the last thing I said to her was, I love you. And let me tell you, you can't put a price on that. You know, a couple of people know that I was in Chicago yesterday talking at a one-day retreat on love, tolerance, and forgiveness. And, you know, I flew back in today and I'm here today. You know, if you're new and you want to just like, God, you've got like 31 years sober. It's like, why would you keep doing this so often? Well, there's really two reasons. One is, I need you way more than you need me. Simple as that. I could get drunk tomorrow. You guys will still be here. Right? And the second reason is because everything that's good in my life, everything, is a direct result of me putting Alcoholics Anonymous first. Simple as that. I have peace about my dad, my mom, the relationships in my life, because Alcoholics Anonymous has given me that. You know? Well, there's actually a third reason. You know, I don't know if you've ever been to a bad meeting. Maybe you hear in meetings sometimes, "Ooh, I've never been to a bad meeting." And I'd say, really? Keep going. You'll find one. Right? I mean, I've been to some meetings where it's like, wow, how do these people stay sober, right? And I remember being at a meeting. This was not that long ago either, right? And my sponsor called me and says, "Hey, man, how was the meeting?" I said, "Oh, my God, the inmates were running the asylum tonight, man. It was crazy." He goes, "The inmates were running the asylum, huh?" He goes, "You know what your problem is? You're sober a little while. You actually think you're the doctor." He goes, "You're still one of the patients, pal." Ouch. But he's right. It's like, I never get better then. I've just been doing it longer. That's all. I'm like a few days of non-spiritual growth away from like getting drunk. And I know that. Because now that I'm getting to get back into my story, I'll tell you how I know that. I've got my dream life. Beautiful wife, two beautiful boys, great job. I mean, my problem is my sponsor's passed away. I don't have a new sponsor. I got no one checking on my behavior, on my thinking, on, hey, you know what, I'm thinking about doing this. I'll believe it. Oh, that's a great idea. Of course it's a great idea. I thought of it. If I say an idea like that to my sponsor, I go, are you out of your mind? No, you're not going to do that. You're not even going to think about doing that. That's crazy. Well, I don't have a sponsor. So it's like I'm believing everything that's going on. I'm going to meetings because fortunately when I moved back to Chicago from Hawaii, there's a meeting in my hotel 5 nights a week. It's great. I'm at meetings like 4 nights a week. But I have 2 small kids. I start calling home at night. Honey, how you doing? Not good. Well, what's going on? Your son just broke a lamp. I'm about to throw him out the window. Honey, we live on the 22nd floor. Don't throw him out the window, okay? I'll be home. And I just started going home. It's like, that's my job. I'm their dad. I'm going to go home. I'm going to take care of my kids. Taking care of my kids, my wife, my job became more important than my primary purpose. And I never saw it happening because I don't have a sponsor. I don't have anybody saying, hey, dude, what are you doing? I haven't seen you in a meeting in a week. What's going on? I'm just checking, check. I'm okay. Tonight I feel okay. When the fact of the matter is I'm clueless. And when I don't have this as a core, then I'm going to act badly. You know what? And I started acting badly. I started living in a way that was incongruent. I became moody and angry and selfish. It's like I no longer thought, what can I bring to my marriage? What can I bring? It's like, okay, went to work today, check. Did the dishes, check. Gave the kids their baths, check. Did this, and I was like, I'm keeping a list. Honey, how about a little something for me? All right, I'm doing everything. Because I'm self-centered to the extreme. That's my problem. Now, if you would have told me when I was new, selfishness is, you know, that's my problem, I'd say, no, it's not. Drinking's my problem. Well, drinking was my solution. Selfishness is my problem, but when I'm not checked, that's what happens. And over a year and a half, I started acting worse and worse and worse, and I ended up getting divorced. So he's like, look, you know what? I didn't sign up for this detail. You're crazy. You know what? You're mean. Thank God you've never hurt the kids, but I mean, she goes, I don't even want to be around you. And if you could see, if there was like such thing, I'm sure there's some football fans here. You know, the sky cam? It's like, was he inbounds? Was he out of bounds? Like the Super Bowl, what's his name? Manningham. Did he catch it? Did he not catch it, right? You get the truth. Well, if there was an AA sky cam for how I was acting that last year and a half of my marriage, you'd be like, dude, you're about to drink. You're crazy. But in my mind, no, it's just, you know, it's just not that bad, right? Well, when they left Chicago and moved to Carolina, I was sitting in this big house that, you know, my job had given me and blah, 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 blah. And I was working really hard for like a month. And I remember there was a big party at the hotel. And they started breaking open this really expensive wine. First time in 18 years, I just looked at that wine. I thought, you know what? That just doesn't sound like a bad idea. All I can tell you is I had a moment of grace. Because as soon as I thought that, it's like I heard a voice. No, you're not going to do that. You're going to go find a meeting right now. I looked at my boss and said, look, I can't stay here. Go do what you got to do. So I went to this meeting and I had a second moment of grace. Coincidentally, this meeting was like about a half a mile from the house I was living in that I hadn't been to since I lived there. Okay? That's how clueless I can get. The second moment of grace happened when I raised my hand. I said, my name's Thomas. I'm almost 18 years sober, and 30 minutes ago I took a drink. You know, I can't do that. I can't muster that kind of ego deflation to say that. I mean, 18 years sober, I want to quote the big book. I don't want to say I almost took a drink 30 minutes ago. It's like, what are you, crazy? You're 18? I don't want to do that. But my hand went up, and the words came out. And if you could have heard what I said, I can tell you, I did not say, my sponsor passed away. I haven't had a sponsor in like over a year. My meetings have cut from like 4 to 1 or 0 a week. I haven't helped an alcoholic in probably a year. I wouldn't have said any of that. It was like, they're not giving me enough recognition at work. My wife isn't giving me enough sex. My kids are a pain in my ass. These are the reasons I would have listed. That's alcoholism. Okay? That's complete self-centeredness. That's a guy without a solution. That's how at 18 years, it's like, well, no kidding, you almost drank, right? but I can lie to myself that way. Then I had the third moment of grace. Next guy raised his hand. I've since heard the story. He wasn't even going to come to the meeting. He's an attorney. He was working downtown, and this meeting was way out in the suburbs of Chicago. He was late. He knew there wasn't going to be a seat. And he ended up showing up like 5 minutes after the meeting started, and he was sitting like back in the corner of the room on the piano bench. And he heard all this garbage that I was like spewing out. And he waited a few comments, and then he raised his hand. And once again, I felt like I was in the ring with Mike Tyson when he was good. He just beat the hell out of me. And I was like, yep, that makes sense. Yep, that makes sense. Yep, that makes sense. Yep, true. Thought that. And I, like the first time, humbly went up to him. Says, hey, man, you know what? I really appreciated your comment. It really spoke to me. I kind of need a sponsor. And he looked at me and goes, yeah, no kidding. And he has since, taken me through the steps again. And the steps, meetings are great. I have to go to meetings. But meetings are like, they're like being sick and going to the hospital. And you have a great nurse. And she fluffs your pillow and she gets you more pudding and gives you a sponge bath and blah, 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 blah. But you know what? If I don't get the surgery, I die. Meetings are great. It's great to see people. It's great to have fellowship, right? Friendly faces, group unity. We all suffer from the same thing. That's awesome. The steps are the surgery. So I have to get an understanding of what these steps look like in my life if I want to get better. Because they tell me, I don't know who they are, but they say it, that the same person will drink again. So when I get to step one this time, I look at it a little differently. I'm powerless over alcohol. That's it. It means I can't drink. Then there's a dash. That means that thought is over. There's a new thought. My life had become unmanageable. What does that look like? I mean, it's easy to see the unmanageability of my life when I'm drinking. It's the wrecked cars and the lost jobs and all the stuff that's visible. But the unmanageability that they're talking about there is what I'm like when I'm not drinking. What do I feel like? Why do I get so crazy? The guys that I sponsored, I tell them, I said, all right, this is what I want you to do. For 1 month, every day, I want you to feel the pull of your alcoholism. Every time your stomach gets like that, just jot it down. We'll figure it out. Just jot it down. Let's see what that looks like. How does a person look? Sobriety always precedes drunkenness. Always. I mean, at some point I'm sober. So how do I get from sober to where this thing over here that's killing me, that's causing me problems and pain, how do I get where I'm like, I'm sober, I don't really feel that great, but how does this thing that's killing me look attractive? This is what it looks like to me. I wake up late because I've hit the snooze alarm 5 times. I don't have time to get out of my head and say, God, please help me. I get in my car, I get on the road with no coffee because I don't have time for coffee, and everybody on the road wants to cut me off. Mother. I get to work late because I am late. My boss wants to give me a hard time. I'm driving home from work, still pissed off because I woke up late. People on the road didn't like know that I was the only person on the road. My boss gave me a hard time. I'm upset. I get home, and there she is, woman of my dreams. Doesn't want to be affectionate with me. All of a sudden, I've got all this stuff going on that I have no control over that makes me so uncomfortable that the only thing that's going to fix it is a drink. That's why when I get to the second step, I understand drinking's not my problem. Lack of power, that's what the book says. Lack of power, that's our dilemma. Now, I don't know about you, but if you would have made a list to me what my dilemma was, lack of power it wasn't even on my radar. What does that mean, lack of power? It means all that stuff that I just described, I don't have the power to do anything about it. Maybe not hit the snooze button, but other than that, the traffic and the boss, and I have no power over that. I have no power over the first drink. I need to find a power that can help me solve my problem. It's funny because that's what it says. This is what this book is about. That's the main object. There's a lot of good stuff in this book. I mean, really, a ton of good stuff. But the main object is to help me find this power. I need a power that can help me. I cannot do it by myself. So when I finally get to the third step, understanding that I need some power, I have to make a decision. Now, you've heard in meetings, well, the third step is just making the decision to move on to the fourth step. Really? That's not the way it reads, but at least in the book that I have, it's like I'm making the decision to turn my will and my life. Doesn't mean I'm joining a monastery, over to the care of God. So yeah, it does mean I'm going to move on to the fourth step, but I mean, basically, to me, underneath that is, this is what my life looks like when I'm drinking. It's craziness, okay? And over here, there's this loving higher power that might help me if I just try to seek. God could and would if he were sought, but I have to do the seeking. And again, the guys that I sponsor, this is what I do. When we get to the third step, I said, before you start, I want you to go home tonight, and I want you to YouTube the word riot. They're like, what? I said, just YouTube the word riot. I don't know if you've ever done that, but there are some really awesome footage of, like, you know, looting and people blowing stuff up and shooting, and it's like lots of craziness. And they'll come see me the next day, and they're like, all right, fine, I looked up riot. What? I said, that's your life when you drink. That's your life. No, it's not that bad. I said, it's funny, because the next line is, but they usually don't think so. Right? It's funny why I have you do that, and you tell me it's not that bad. We're the extreme example of self will run riot. If selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem, then I have to get in there and dig the root out. I mean, when I was a kid, we had a very big yard covered in dandelions. You know what dandelions are, right? They're like a weed. Yellow, they pop up. Well, out of the eight kids, I was the one, always got elected. We need you to pull the dandelions. Well, if you've ever done that, you know what a pain in the butt it is. Because you can't just, like, pull the heads off. They come back, like, in a day. You got to go in there with that, I forget what it's called. It's not a sickle, but it's whatever it's called. Go in there, dig it out. Well, I'm an alcoholic. I don't have the patience or the tolerance for that. It's like, you get me, like, through the first five, okay, I'm done. I get the lawnmower, no more dandelions. Right? Gone. Lawn looks great. The problem is, 3 days later, I'm full of dandelions. That's the way sometimes I treat my alcoholism. I want to get everything looking good on the surface, but I haven't gotten to the root of the problem. I want to look good, and hey, the guy's in a suit, he looks good. Meanwhile, I'm a maniac on the inside, just waiting to find another wall I can put my fist through, because I don't get to the root. So I have to get to a place of complete surrender where, all right, here's my problem. And so I move on to the fourth step. And I start writing. And I do it just the way it's written here. I got the columns. Fourth column, it's 2 pages later. It's hidden in there, but you can find it. You don't see it in the book, but it's actually in there. What's my part in it? A lot of times these resentments that I have, it's that I'm still pissed off, that I won't let go of it. That's, you know. And I tell somebody. The stuff that I'm never going to tell anybody. The stuff that makes me feel different, separate, isolated. I do that, then I get to 6 and 7. It's like, all right, I got all these character defects that have caused me to act this way for so long. And, you know, character defects, it's like now that I'm sober a little while, sometimes I treat those character defects like they're a credit card. You know, I'm going to act out a little bit. I'm not going to tell anybody. I'm not going to worry about it. I'm just going to just put it on my card, right? I'm not going to tell anyone about this one either. I just want to have a little fun. My sponsor doesn't need to go. I'm going to the strip club. Here, just put it on my card, right? The problem is, at the end of the month, the bill comes. I look at my credit card statement. Oh, my God, what happened? When I act like that on my character defects, at the end of the month, and I wonder why I'm so crazy and I'm starting to, like, a drink looks good to me again, maybe I need to say, hey, geez, maybe I need to stop charging this stuff. And I don't mean, like, charge it literally. I just mean thinking I'm getting away with something that's really causing me pain. Because that's what it does. It causes me pain when I don't act the way I know I'm supposed to act. So, you know, he continues to take me through the steps, and I get to 10. And, you know, these days, that's what I work on. I work on 10, 11, and 12. And my 10-step inventory, it's just an honest look at how I'm doing. Sometimes, if I'm not in a good space, if I'm not praying a lot, I don't know if you ever saw the movie The Breakfast Club. Okay, a couple of you. I won't use the reference then. Don't worry about it. I will beat myself up mercilessly when I'm on my knees at night like, you no good, Lord. It's like, you, is it really, is that the best you could do? And it says right in here, I'm not supposed to drift into morbid self-reflection. It's supposed to say, you know, here's where I screwed up today. God, please help me. I don't want to do that again. Help me do it better tomorrow. You know, and so when I get to step 11, book says I'm not supposed to be shy about the matter of prayer. And those are probably the two least talked about subjects in Alcoholics Anonymous, prayer and sex. I'm not talking about those, you know. I'm not going to do that. Even though they're in the book, they really are. I shouldn't be shy about it. You know, something I've been reading every day for a long time, pages 86 to 88. If you don't know how to pray, and you're not at step 11, and this is my sponsor told me, he says, look, you can jump ahead on that one. You can start praying day one. You don't have to wait till step 11 to pray and meditate to try to get. And so I'm praying. Now I can tell you this. It says in step 11 that I'm supposed to improve my conscious contact. If I'm praying the same way today at 31 years sober that I was at 31 days sober, I'm missing the boat. You know, I'm supposed to improve it. It's like anything. If I want to be a better guitarist, I got to play. Better golfer, got to play. Whatever your trade is, whatever you do, it's like if I want to get better, I have to do it. So I pray. And I'll tell you why I pray. And I'll tell you about my two favorite words in the big book. Because they've helped me out of more scrapes than anything. I don't need the book. I'm just like twiddling through for fun. But I'm going to get to it in a second. As we go through the day, we pause. Okay? When agitated. I don't know about you, but I'm not a pauser. Okay? I'm like not even a reactor. I'm more like a nuclear reactor. It's like when I get agitated, I just hit the button and I'm ready to launch the nukes, okay? And look, I've had a lot of great pauses in my sobriety because I've had things happen that haven't been real favorable. You know, I was in Hurricane Katrina. You know? I lost all my stuff. I mean, it's not bad enough that in my divorce, which, look, I'm not the victim of that. I caused that. I lost all my stuff. Well, I finally got back on my feet. I felt okay again. Hurricane Katrina, boom, lost all my stuff. And I remember during Hurricane Katrina, like there was like nonstop video footage of how traumatic it was and like stuff just floating everywhere and people on rooftops. And I remember getting a call from my ex-wife saying, hey, you know, your son got into a little trouble. I need you to send me a check for $2,000. And I paused. Okay. And in my head, I thought, are you kidding me? Like, have you been watching the footage? Do you know what's going on? I mean, do you even own a TV? I knew she owned a TV. She got the TV and it was in the divorce. It was a good TV. It's like, come on. I didn't say any of that. I just thought, like, you've got to be kidding me. I said, sure, I'll send it tomorrow. It's not because I'm like some great guy. It's because that's what Alcoholics Anonymous taught me. I'm not a victim anymore. There was a problem. I need to try to solve it. I need to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. You know? And look, relationships are hard. It says, you know, defective relations with others is nearly always the cause of our woes, including my alcoholism. I don't know how to relate to other people. That's why I need to learn how to pause, because people constantly piss me off because they don't act the way I want them to. I remember at Christmas, you know, I've been divorced for 13 years now, right? And every year, I go to Carolina. Every month, I go, and I get a hotel, and I take the kids, and, you know, that's I try to be present in their lives. I don't care about the expense. It's, that's what I'm supposed to do. I mean, pat me on the back. You might as well pat me on the back for not stealing the collection basket tonight, right? It's like, that's just what I'm supposed to do. And every year I go down there for Christmas. It's like a special time. I don't have to stay in a hotel that month. I get to stay at the house. Christmas morning, we all get to wake up. But I've learned to never take that for granted. It's like she allows me to do that. So I always call her, like a month out. Hey, what's the plan for Christmas? Everything all set? Yep, sure, no problem, come on. This year, I called her like every year, a month out. I get no call back. I call her 3 weeks out. I get no call back. I call her 2 weeks out. I still get no call back. And finally, I'm like, what the heck? Right? 3 days before Christmas, I call her. She answers the phone. And I was like, did you get my messages? Yeah, you know, I've been meaning to call you. And I paused. And in my head, it's like there was a bunch of four-letter words. Okay? And I was like, so what's the deal? That's what came out of my mouth. She goes, well, you know, my sister's coming with the kids, and so we don't think it's a good idea that you come this year. And I paused. I had another bunch of four-letter words. And I thought, unbelievable. It's like, you're telling me 2 days before, it's like, so I don't even have a plan for Christmas. And I have all this, like, self-justified anger towards her. And I'm cursing at her in my head. And I said, okay. Do the kids know? Well, no, I thought you could tell them. Yeah. And I paused again, you know. And I just said, okay. I got them on the phone. And I told them. And when I told them, I didn't like put any twist on it. I just said, you know, your cousins are coming down. It's going to be a good time. You can hang with them. And I'll come down the week after. Okay. And don't worry, I'll be packing. I still know it's Christmas. Don't worry. All right. You know, and wow, I should have looked at my watch sooner. So here's the other reason I pray. Okay. And why I try to pray a lot. This is really important. When I pray, this is what it says the results are. I'm in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decision. That sounds like a list that I don't want to have any of that, right? But here's the best. We don't tire so easily. Why is that important? I don't know about you, but to me, alcoholics are the most tired people in the world. I mean, serious. After the meeting, just ask somebody how they're doing. Oh, man, I'm tired. Right? How often do you hear that? It's like all the time, I'm tired. It's like, you should pray. You'd be less tired. I mean, really, I have a lot of energy, and I'm convinced because I pray. You know, and then the last thing, it's like, having had a spiritual awakening, my spirit was dead. I have a spiritual problem. Drinking wasn't my problem. My spirit was dead. I got the spiritual awakening because I worked the steps. Okay? I try to practice these principles. I mean, it's just, I do the best I can. I try to love people. I lift them up. I don't tear them down. I lift them up. You know? And I try to carry this message to people that need help. You know, so when somebody says, hey, can you come to our group? I don't care. Yes. The answer is yes. All right? I could never be busy enough in Alcoholics Anonymous to repay everything that's good in my life that's happened over the last 31 years. So if you're new, welcome. Jump in. Thanks.